Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. Live and in person, I'm H. Bosch Jr.
And I am Guy Schaefer. Today we are going to be talking with activists and policymakers at the annual lobbying day for single-payer health care at the New York Capitol.
Then in my segment on the Triple E's, Education, Empowerment, and Entrepreneurship, I'll be speaking with Kevin Pryor, owner and CEO of the mentoring program Troy Look.
Afterwards, we'll hear from labor correspondent Willie Terry, who spoke with former NYC Transit Union president Roger Toussaint about contemporary issues and lessons in the labor movement.
And later on, WOOC correspondent Jonah Milberg will be speaking with activist and scholar Tommy Weddington. Let's start the show off with some rapid-fire local headlines.
A review by the USA Today Network's Albany Bureau found that despite New York's insistence it is adding significantly more money to fight the abuse of heroin and other dangerous drugs, the state has largely just shifted funds from other addiction programs to pay for it. In April 2017, Governor Andrew Cuomo held a ceremonial bill signing on Long Island, proclaiming the state would now invest $200 million a year to fight the scourge of opioid addiction in New York, without acknowledging that the state was already spending that much money on the epidemic. John Coppola, executive director of the Alcoholism and Substance Abuse Providers of New York State, explained that most of the dollars were already there, already being utilized by prevention and treatment programs, but now their emphasis shifted to address the opioid epidemic. The number of opioid deaths in New York increased by 135% between 2013 and 2016. In 2016 alone, the state had nearly 3,800 opioid deaths, but only increased its treatment beds by 4%. Hundreds of cities, counties, and states have filed lawsuits against the pharmaceutical industry in the last 3 years based on evidence that pharmaceutical manufacturers had knowledge of the addictive potential of Vicodin and other opioid drugs before they hit the market. The Times Union reports that a Houston-based oil company has been fined for air pollution violations at its terminal at the Port of Albany. Buckeye Albany Terminals agreed to a $15,700 fine for two violations found after state inspectors visited the facility in March. The company was previously fined $181,000 in 2014 for air pollution violations that lasted nearly a year. The Buckeye Terminal is located in an environmental justice area in the south end of Albany, a mile from the Albany Community Charter School, the Addictions Care Center, the Center for Disability Services, and the Prentice Homes. While Buckeye points out that these releases were self-reported, in 2016 the company fought against stricter environmental controls demanded by a coalition of environmental justice advocates, including then Sierra Club president Aaron Mayer. Aaron Mayer said at the time that crude by rail endangers millions of New Yorkers every day through the threat of derailments, spills, and catastrophic explosions, but it is low-income communities and people of color that have borne the disproportionate brunt of this virtual pipeline on rails, especially at the Port of Albany.
In more oil and gas-related news, Senator Charles Schumer is asking federal regulators to quickly finalize a rule establishing volatility standards for federal regulators to quickly finalize a rule establishing volatility standards for crude oil shipped by rail. Federal data shows shipments of Bakken crude oil from North Dakota through the New York State on its way to Northeast refineries is again on the rise. The U.S. Energy Information Administration reports that Northeast refineries used 3.1 million barrels in March, the highest level since early 2017. Oil trains carrying Bakken crude passed through communities from western New York through the Mohawk Valley to Albany, then south along the Mohawk River. Schumer says the shipments put communities at risk of devastating explosion and fire. If tank cars derail or puncture, he wants federal standards to stabilize crude before shipments so it's less explosive.
The Times Union reports that the Make Affordable Housing Work Act, proposed by the Department of Housing and Urban Development, would raise the percentage of income to be paid in rent from 30 to 35% and raise minimum rents from $50 to $150 a month. Housing Secretary Ben Carson said in a recent interview with Fox News that it is the administration's attempt to give poor people a way out of poverty. But the proposal could be disastrous for poor people in subsidized housing in the capital region. Residents receiving public housing assistance stand to see a roughly 17% increase in rent, according to an analysis done by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. This would affect 16,200 households in the Albany area, nearly all of the households receiving assistance. Roughly 34% of the affected population in the capital region is under 18 years of age. In some southern cities, over half the affected population will be children. According to Diane Yentl, CEO of the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, this proposal to raise rents on low-income people doesn't magically create well-paying jobs needed to lift people out of poverty. Instead, it just makes it harder for struggling families to get ahead by potentially cutting them off from the very services that make it possible for them to find and keep jobs.
In national news, New Mexico's poised to elect the nation's first ever Native American congresswoman. Deb Hyland won the Democratic nomination in New Mexico's heavily Democratic 1st District. Hyland is a member of the Laguna Pueblo tribe. She supports Medicare for all and has called the elimination of the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement in her victory speech Tuesday night. Hyland said New Mexico made history, adding that hers was a victory for working people and a victory for women and a victory for everyone who has been sidelined by the billionaire class.
And finally, in arthropod-related news, Assemblyman Angelo Santabarbara wants the state to put money toward efforts to develop a vaccine for Lyme disease. The Democratic lawmaker says New York must remain vigilant about the disease, which he calls an epidemic, and a particular problem in the northeastern states. The bill would set aside state funds earmarked for research into a possible vaccine.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM, Troy.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or favorite rhubarb recipes that you'd like to share with us, you can text us at 518-888-3004. More than 500 people attended the annual single-payer healthcare lobbying day at the state capitol on June 5th. Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Mark Dunley talked to Katie Robbins of the Campaign for New York Health, John Hyland of the Professional Staff Congress, Howie Hawkins of the Green Party, and Albany County Legislator Doug Bullock.
Katie Robbins, who's with the Campaign for New York Health and PNHP. Good turnout today. What's the demand?
We're here demanding that the Assembly and State Senate pass the New York Health Act, a bill which would create a universal single-payer healthcare system that covers all New Yorkers. It would eliminate private health insurance companies and replace it with high-quality, comprehensive coverage with no out-of-pocket costs for every single resident of New York.
Now, didn't Obamacare solve all our problems with the healthcare system?
You know, the Affordable Care Act made progress in expanding health insurance coverage through the marketplace and through Medicaid, but unfortunately, it has not created a universal program that covers everyone, and it really leaves us in the hands of for-profit private insurance companies, which continue the business model of trying to deny care in order to make profits for their shareholders. And they create a tremendous amount of administrative waste and profit. We could use all of that money to actually cover health care through a program like the New York Health Act, which we're here advocating for today.
Now, wasn't there a study done by a professor at University of Massachusetts recently that some estimated amount of money would be saved with the single-payer system?
Yeah, it's estimated over decades of studies have shown significant savings, 10 to 15%, if you move to a universal single-payer healthcare program at the state or the national level. And Professor Friedman's estimates in New York is that we could provide everyone high-quality healthcare and save $45 billion a year. 98% of New Yorkers would spend less on healthcare than they do now with this plan.
Now, the New York State Business Council this week released their own survey that showed the majority of New Yorkers actually like their present healthcare system, and only about a third of the population was supportive of a single payer. Any response to the Business Council on that?
Well, the Business Council has been one of the most vocal opponents to our plan. Polling has shown time and again, especially recently, that support is increasing for the ideas behind a single payer system. Sometimes they frame the polls in a scary way. I didn't see the exact wording. You know, if it's described as a government-run healthcare system that raises your taxes, people tend to not like that. But if you talk about the benefits of such a program, universal, comprehensive, guaranteed, no out-of-pocket costs, people are for it. So I'm not swayed by the Business Council telling us that people aren't in favor of it. We know that from our own personal experiences, anecdotes from how this works from around in countries around the world, that these kind of programs are very popular.
Now, I know that the Assembly has passed the bill at least three times. The problem tends to be more in the Senate. Any optimism that the Senate is going to be coming on board anytime soon?
Well, we know that no matter who's in power, we need a grassroots movement that is going to hold them accountable and make sure that they create a truly guaranteed healthcare system like the New York Health Act. So we hope that the people who've been championing this bill, you know, are able to move it forward should they take control of the Senate in November after the elections. But we know that we aren't going anywhere. We'll be back to keep pushing them to do the right thing on healthcare. We can't have any more deaths, no more bankruptcies. You know, we have the solution, we have the resources, we have the healthcare providers. We just need the political will.
So if people want to find out more about the New York Health Campaign, what's the best way to do that?
They should visit us at our website, nyhcampaign.org. That's nyhcampaign.org.
And that was Katie Robbins with the campaign and PNHP. So we're talking with John Hyland, who's I know been with retirees from the Professional Staff Congress. John, why should, you know, retirees, union members support single-payer health care?
Well, for two reasons. One, it affects us very directly, right? I mean, we're covered by Medicare and, you know, the whole social safety net. However, that we know that that's in jeopardy. We know that, you know, powerful forces nationally and you know, federally are out to, you know, cut that. So it's certainly a protection for ourselves. But either above and beyond that, what's important is that healthcare is a right of every human being. And we need a system that provides that, regardless of occupation or class or race or gender or anything else. Human beings deserve healthcare. It's part of life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, right? So we're certainly in favor of it in terms of our own needs and our own self-interest, but, you know, much more, it's a class-wide issue. I mean, people who work for a living, provide all the products and services of the society, should live in dignity and have decent health care.
Now, on a lot of the labor fights these days over union contracts or any contract, isn't health care a big factor in that?
Well, that's a third reason. Thank you. Sure, because what's happening is collective bargaining has turned into healthcare bargaining, right? So, you know, the costs, incredibly increasing costs, eat up the resources that would ordinarily go into, wages and salaries, right? So you read about any collective bargaining campaign going on now, often the key issue is not wages and salary, but it's health care. And, you know, people, some unions are giving back wages and salary in order to keep health care. It's crazy. And especially in face of the incredible wealth that exists in the country, it's irrational. It's unjust for that money to be concentrated like that when there's such a need like this. So, but it's very important for the labor movement.
Thank you, John Hyland, for speaking to WOC. So we're talking with Doug Bullock, among many things, a member of the Albany County Legislature.
Hello, everybody.
As a local government official, why do you think we should have a single-payer health care?
Well, I just ran a proclamation through the Albany County Legislature for single-payer health care, the New York Health Act, and they signed on. A majority of them signed on to the proclamation for single-payer because it saves the county money. We could roll back county taxes with this. It's an important fiscal issue because there's too much being spent on health care right now, and there's too much nonsense going on with the bureaucratic system that we have.
So next we caught up with Howie Hawkins, the Green Party candidate for governor. I know, Howie, you've been calling for single-payer health care for quite a few years. Why?
Because it would cover all medically necessary services for all New Yorkers at lower costs than we're now paying in the multi-payer system, where we all pay taxes for Medicare, Medicaid, and the other public programs. And then if we're not in those programs, we got to pay premiums, co-pays, deductibles. And under this system, 98% of us in New York would pay less than we're now paying. And we get a better plan. It covers all medically necessary services. With a lot of these insurance plans we got now, the private insurance doesn't cover all the services. Sometimes you got to fight for services they do cover because they make more money when they don't pay for your services. And then Medicare, which we have federally, doesn't cover all services. I'm on Medicare now, and it doesn't cover the one thing I need to do about every 6 weeks to take care of my feet. So this is a much better plan, and it will lower the cost of health care for local governments, which will save taxpayers money. It will lower the health care costs for businesses. Rising health care costs are the biggest driver of increasing costs of doing business in this state. I mean, there's so many things going for it that it's astonishing that we don't have it yet. But we're getting close. It's passed the Assembly 3 times. It's 1 vote short in the state Senate. Governor Cuomo has said, quote unquote, it's a good idea. Unfortunately, he didn't put it in his State of the Union, State of the State address or his budget. So what I'm saying he needs to do now is get off the dime and pressure the Senate. Let's have a vote on this before the voters go to the polls in the fall so they know where people stand. This is popular with the people, and the voters deserve to know where their senators stand.
Thank you, Howie Hawkins.
So we caught back up with Doug Bullock after the sound system got improved a little bit. Doug's at Albany County Legislature. Besides passing a resolution in the county legislature, have you also been working with local labor groups?
Yes, both the Troy Area Labor Council and the Albany Central Federation of Labor, Albany County, passed the resolution on single payer for the Senate and the Assembly for New York State.
And what were some of the reasons that motivated local labor to come out in favor?
The big reason is it takes this off the bargaining table. It takes health care off the bargaining table. And health care is one of the most expensive items in the contract. And it takes it right out. It takes days and days of negotiation off the table. And it now is much cheaper for employees to have health care through the employer system.
Has the state AFL-CIO weighed in yet?
State AFL-CIO has weighed in favor of this. We're all set. We passed it through the Capital District Area Labor Federation, so we're all on board for New York Health Act.
Thank you, Doug Bullock.
That was the Hudson Mohawk Magazine report on single-payer healthcare rally at the state capitol on June 5th.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM. Next up, H. Bosch Jr. brings you the Triple E's, Education, Empowerment, and Entrepreneurship.
In this week's segment, I sat down with Kevin K.P. Pryor, founder and executive director of Troy Look. 2, 3. Hello again, everyone. This is H. Bosch Jr. of the Triple E segment, Education, Empowerment, Entrepreneurship. Today's guest on the show is Mr. Kevin Pryor, owner and CEO of Look. Thank you so much for showing up, sir.
Well, thank you for having me.
We appreciate you for showing up and taking time out of your busy schedule. So as I always say before I start my show, let's make it do what it do.
Let's make it do what it do.
Okay, and when it's done, it's done.
All right.
So let me ask you this. I want to dig right in. What is the name of your organization? It's called Look?
Troy Look.
Okay, Troy Look. Okay.
I'm from Troy.
Okay.
So the title fits perfectly.
Okay. And I hear a living legend on the basketball courts back in the day.
I am.
Yes, sir.
Still today.
All right. Killer crossover. Uh-huh. Okay. So Troy Look stands for?
Look stands for Life Options, Opportunity, and Knowledge, something that we truly, truly believe in.
Okay.
When everybody decide to make a decision, you have all the acronyms right there. Look, life options and opportunity, knowledge. You got to have knowledge.
Okay. I can totally appreciate that. Now, what does Look stand for? You told me that. What does Look stand for? Okay. So what programs do you have and pertaining to the community then?
Well,
and what you offer.
Well, what we began with when we started Troy Look, 2002, I think we started it. We just had an idea to have a mentoring program, utilizing the men from our neighborhoods because they know the kids in the neighborhood. It makes it more better We have the Speak Out program where we go to speak to different schools and stuff like that about our programs. We have the Step It Up, Pull 'Em Up, the anti-SAG.
I like that. Yeah. Step It Up, Pull It Up, right? Pull up your pants.
Yes, sir. I'm trying to get young men and older men to look like H. Bosch.
Ah.
You know, always looking good. You know, looking
thank
good.
You, sir.
Runway ready. That's what I tell a kid when I see him sagging.
Yep. And I'll tell them, if you could offer them anything, just tell them that. I say to people, it ain't easy being me, but some days it's sure a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah, you know, I know
sure
the feeling.
A lot of fun.
I know the
all
feeling.
Right. Moving right along. Yeah. So, see my engineer, he's on the ball. All my guys,
I
they make
it.
Me look good.
I love it.
So then, what made you start this program?
Well,
what was the inspiration behind it?
The men in my life that helped me out along when I was growing up.
Talk of that, yes, male mentors.
Yes, starting with my father and my uncles, you know, Mr. Tucker on 9th Street, the Branches, my father, Delphus Pryor, the Browns, and then you got the Earl Harrison, and you got the Roy Pompeys, the basketball coach, the Al Prater's, all these guys that was there to help me. You know, it was only through God that I learned this lesson to give back. So that's why I wanted to started this program. So anything I started has something to do with the kids in the community.
Okay. So then what's some of your goals?
Oh, for them all to succeed. You know, my goals are for the little men to become men.
Ah,
you know,
in
scripture it says when I was a boy, I did things. When I was a child, I did things of a child. But when I grew as a man, I put my childish things away. That's what I want these little boys to learn. That's why we call the mentoring program Boys to Men.
Let me throw some scripture that brings, when I think of you, this comes to mind. A man's gift shall make room for him, and he shall be amongst greatness.
Wow.
Well, you have a gift, Mr. Pryor, and it's making room for you. You just keep on keeping on.
That's awesome.
Okay. So now, who do you serve with your programs?
I serve the whole community. Not only Troy, but all over. I've been all over pretty much the United States, Kentucky I've been to. My information is all over the place because I'm partner with Trip Housing.
Oh,
and they do. They go to conference all over the country.
Okay.
And I was fortunate to be
part
of that.
Will you tell Miss Davia Collington I said hello?
I will do. I will do. And I collaborate with the Troy Boys and Girls Club, Team Hero, so many organizations we get together with to make this happen, make it do what it do.
I like that. I think I heard that before, Jonah, right? If not, I'm going to use that, all right? I like that. Wow, all right. So then, so you serve families, and from what I understand, it is, you know, a wide variety.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Black, white,
Chinese.
Yes, you know, so it's just not pigeonholed to, you know, one specific gender or group or nationality.
Not. Because God don't, he this is just not one with God. Well, you know, he's have so many peoples. So we, in our anti-bullying program, when we first started, it's an anti-prevention program with boxing. And when we started, we're in the media, we're on the news, and it was so blessed. It was a blessing that we got a call from Emma Willard School.
Oh,
so we have two young
That's
ladies
big.
In our program from Emma Willard School.
That's big.
One is Asian. And one is Dominican.
Okay.
And they come there, and they, man, it's like nothing in the world.
Okay. So now, before we go into the next segment of the few questions I have left, let me just say this is H. Bosch Jr., WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy, New York. Today's guest, in case you're just tuning in, is none other than Kevin Pryor. He is the founder and chairman of Look Organization. So we're going to dig right back
in.
I love it. So talk a little bit about what you got coming up in June.
Oh, man.
That's going to be have something to do with fathers and daughters.
Man,
that's really exciting.
One of our biggest things, and my biggest thing, is because is fathers, man. Father, with so many fathers are like out of the kids' lives now.
Mm-hmm.
So we're able to bring our father-daughter dance, and it was amazing last year. First one last year at the Troy Boys and Girls Club.
That is phenomenal.
We thought we were gonna get like 25 people. We got 75 people to come to the event. this year, I mean, we got Bella Napoli, we got Red Front Pizza, we have everybody, Jimmy's, we got everybody's jumping on board with this.
So it's a collaborative effort.
Oh, my God. Because
business,
yes.
As well as the private sector.
Yes.
And is the city supporting you at all? You know, local government? If not, don't worry about it. You know, small thing to a big giant,
that's
right?
That's it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the father-daughter dance, again, it brings so much joy in these kids' lives, man, when they're with their father. Some of these kids' father are not around, mm-hmm. but they came in town for this.
Right.
It's amazing, man. I swear. Right.
I think it's important that little girls have their fathers in their lives.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's so, so important, you know, and as well as moms, too, you know, but to have a man there, because they're going to go through changes, and when they meet someone, you know, they need the type of father that's going to pull out a shotgun and roll up on them.
You're right.
Just joking.
No, don't even joke.
Yeah, you messing with my little girl, but no, they need that guidance, and some things they just can't, you know, I'm not taking anything from moms, because moms hold it down. But sometimes little girls need a man's point of view.
And
I'm glad you're putting emphasis on that. Yeah,
I have a 13-year-old daughter, and man, I'm so jealous right now because she's 13 right now.
She's pushing.
She don't want to hang out with me no more.
Right, and everything is why.
But again, like you said, the mothers, man, I just take my hat off to the mothers because I know so many single mothers that
are mom and dad.
Yeah,
you hear that? There's so many mothers that are mom and dad, and I give you all the credit in the world. But there's some of us fathers who are stepping up to the plate.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You have to.
Yes, exactly. When someone says, well, you're an exception instead of the rule, no, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing.
I'm doing what I do.
Yes, exactly.
Doing what I do. Do what my father taught me.
So tell me, where is this going to be exactly in the date and time?
Okay. It should be on the flyer there.
I don't want to get false information. Okay, I want everybody to hear about this.
All right, the father-daughter dance, Troy Boys and Girls Club in Troy. Look, father-daughter gala. June 15, 2018, party events and banquet hall, 309 3rd Avenue, Troy, New York, 12182. And this is the best part of it. $25 will get three people in, a father and his two daughters, father and his two
Great,
you can't beat that.
No, you can't.
You can't beat that. We're not trying to make a profit.
It's not about money. This
we're
is about
love.
Yeah, bringing awareness and exposure to a great, great cause.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
Before I end, I want to give a shout out to Miss Karen Bobo.
Karen Bobo.
We made it happen. All right. And like I said, when Karen Bobo calls, you say yes. Hello, and yes, ma'am, at the end of the conversation. You do what you're told.
Do what you do.
Yes. Now, real quick, how can people reach you with your program?
They can reach me at my phone number is 518-328-2106, or they can go to Facebook and look us up on
take your time.
Kevin Pryor on Facebook, or Speak Out Program, or just Kevin.Pryor2011@gmail.com.
Hey, Mr. Pryor, well, I say again, thank you so much for showing up.
Man, I said thank
you. You are truly making a difference in the community, and brothers like you, we need more of. I'm telling you, you are a true difference maker. And,
well, we need more mentors like you. That's the only way I can do what I do.
Thank you so much, man. Yeah, I'm humbled and honored for that, and I appreciate it. And I'm going to close out like this. Until next time, folks. It's about the triple E's, education, empowerment, entrepreneurship. And remember this, you don't hear about making a difference. You need to be about making a difference.
Amen.
This is Inez Bosch's baby boy, H. Bosch Jr., doing what I'm made to believe. Mr. Kevin Pryor. Thank you, Mr. Kevin Pryor, for a great interview and educating us on this outstanding organization. I love this name. Look, life, options, opportunity, knowledge.
For those just tuning in, I'm Guy Schaefer.
And I'm H. Bosch Jr. You're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy, New York.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or if you want help in identifying an insect, you can text us at 518-888-3004. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region. Next up, Labor Talk host and roaming correspondent Willie Terry attended the Left Forum conference entitled Towards a New Strategy for the Left in New York City, June 1st to 3rd at John Jay College, where he interviewed former New York City MTA Transit Union President Roger Toussaint on about contemporary issues and lessons in the labor movement.
This is a Labor Talk correspondent, Willie Terry, and I'm here at the Left Forum. I have as my guest Roger Toussaint, former president of the Transit Worker Union in New York. And how you doing, Roger?
Very good.
Roger, just tell us something about yourself, you know, because the audience may not know you, but...
Right. Well, as you said, for 9 years, I was the president of Transport Workers Union Local 100 in New York City, which represents all of the subway workers and most of the bus depots in the boroughs of New York City. The membership is close to 40,000 members. And it is the largest transportation union in the country. Before that, I was also a union officer in one of the divisions of Transport Workers Union for 6 years. My background prior to that was in community organizing and some campus organizing. And before that, I was an activist in Trinidad and Tobago, where I came from. At the age of 17, I emigrated from Trinidad to Brooklyn. In Trinidad, my activism began around the Black Power revolt there in 1970. Grew after that until I was arrested down there and expelled from school. Then I emigrated from Trinidad in 1974. I was active in the student movement at Brooklyn College and in various organizations involved in the fight against the racist killing of black youths in Brooklyn and around New York City, and in various organizations of activists who had come out of the struggles of the 60s and 70s.
Roger, I noticed you got the last name Toussaint. You know, Toussaint was the famous revolutionary Haitian leader. Are you in that genetic?
I'm not sure. I don't know. I do have family from my great-great-grandparents who were from Haiti. So that is possible, but I am not aware.
Oh, okay. Now, what brought you to Left Forum?
Well, actually, I was simply asked by a friend and colleague, a professor at Tuskegee University, to participate in a panel on race and labor-related issues. In honor of his request, I agreed to come down and participate in the panel and make a presentation, which I just completed. So I'm just here for that panel, and I'm leaving.
Okay. The panel that you did was about contemporary lessons in black labor organization. So, in your opinion, what are some of the contemporary lessons in the black community labor organizations, and why?
Well, my experience is kind of directly related to that topic because as a black man, I became the leader of one of the most prominent unions in New York and around the country, and for a very powerfully strategically located section of the workforce, which is transportation in New York City. And as your listeners might know, in 2005, I led the strike of transportation workers in New York City that shut down the city for almost 3 days. The leaders of the city later claimed in court that it costed the city $300 to $400 million per day, just as an indication of the impact. Whether or not that is true, I have not been able to verify that number. But certainly, we took over a very powerfully located organization that had been traditionally run, led by white leadership from Irish background. In which the workforce itself was alienated from the union leadership, and even more so, the people of color, black folks, Hispanics, were even more alienated, as well as women. There were thousands of women who were stuck in mostly entry-level positions as a result of race and gender bias. Lower-paying titles have a disproportionately large number of people of color. So we had to confront racism on the job as well as racism within the union and by the union leadership, which was the only one of their many sins. As I said, the organization had been, the Transport Workers Union, the local, had become deeply alienated from the workforce, from transit workers as a whole. And there were many features to that, but racism was one of the, was certainly one of the others, of course, being working hand in hand with the employers and the bosses to silence people and to crush resistance in the workplace and so on.
Roger, how would you categorize the labor movement, or how do you see the labor movement moving today?
Well, organized labor share of the workforce is now hovering close to 11%. It breaks down as something like 15% in the public sector, 6 or 7% in the private sector, making for an average of around 11%. A decline from its height of about mid-30s, around 35%, 40, 50 years ago. Some people argue that the decline of the market share for organized labor is changing. The data indicates that all that might have happened is that the decline has slowed, but the decline has continued. As a practical matter, this means that when you have 10 working people in a room, 9 of them are not in a union, only one is. That means that you have lost capacity to speak for the room, if you only represent one out of the 10 people in the room. In my opinion, that's a mostly a self-inflicted wound. It's one of the significant failures of the leadership of the labor movement at all levels, because they failed to build bonds of solidarity with other, with people who were not in the unions, workers, other workers, and with communities that were impacted by oppression and injustice. And they undervalued the importance of investing time and resources and attention to maintaining ranks and a front, a united front with all of those interests. So as a result, the labor movement is isolated in a significant way and does not enjoy the sympathy of working people. I have seen polls that have claimed that among working people, labor leaders or organized labor leaders have the same approval ratings as businessmen and bankers, meaning very low, 25% or less approval rating. That means at least the perception among working people is that the leaders of labor are not on their side, are not in their corner, are not fighting their fight. I don't blame the working people for that. I blame the labor leaders for that.
You don't think current administration has something to do with this, or you think it's all self-inflicted process that keep labor in that position?
When you say the current administration, you mean the Trump administration?
Yes.
No, I mean the data and statistics I'm talking about predated Trump. It happened, this has been going on for a number of years. That has been trending that way for long before Trump. Trump has now exacerbated some things. But on the other hand, Trump may turn out to be our best organizer. He might compel people to fight and to organize and link up in ways that they were not inclined to, 5 years ago. A good example of that is the pretty dramatic teacher strikes taking place in a number of the red states. These are demonstrations of thousands and thousands of teachers who probably voted for Trump and who are now been slapped in their faces and spat their faces have been spat in their faces by the governors and the conservative leaders in these states. And that's a wake-up call for them, and we'll see where that leads. So Trump cuts both ways. On the one hand, he will encourage right-wing attacks, more right-wing attacks at all levels, and more indecency and immoral attacks, such as the savage separation of children from their immigrant mothers. And this is just child abuse. I mean, there's not... His chief of staff, Kelly, called it a zero tolerance. It is not zero tolerance, it's child abuse. Literally, child in the world space. Official, unsanctioned, organized child abuse and bullying and so forth. So, things will exacerbate, but it will also prompt people. People could only be pushed so much. We don't know what that line is, but oppression breeds resistance and organization. And I look forward to a future that has more resistance and more organization, that a future that does a better job learning the lessons and applying the lessons, and doing a better job than we did, than my generation did.
Yeah, I just have one last question I wanted to ask you. What advice or views you would like to say to workers?
Well, I think lifelong word of advice of wisdom is organize, organize, organize. When you organize, it multiplies your strength. When you organize, you figure out how to message your issues properly and more effectively. When you organize, you have to clearly identify who your friends and allies are and the importance of those allies and how to strengthen your bonds and ties with those allies. When you organize, you have to be mindful of the things that weaken and undermine you, the fault lines around you, and figure out how to heal those fault lines. Organizing means all of those things. There are no shortcuts, there's no magic bullet, there's no savior coming down from either the heavens or from the White House or from Chicago, or from any of these sources to save us. We can do this, but we have to. We have the capacity, we have the strength, we have the vision, we have the capability. Young people are showing a remarkable tenacity and brilliance. When we were young, we stepped up to the situations that we faced, and now, as is true forever, every generation has to find their own way, and I'm encouraged by the fact that this generation is you're seeing signs and stirrings of attempts to find their own way, and whether that lies in the stirrings you see among the teachers or the youth, the high schools or the Black Lives Matter movement or Fight for 15 or immigrant rights, fight against injustice, against an oppression of immigrants, in all of these social justice areas, you have fights emerging and soldiers emerging and thinkers and visionaries emerging. And at some point, that's going to congeal into a more unified movement and progress.
All right. Thank you, Roger.
That was roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry speaking with Roger Toussaint at the Left Forum Conference in John Jay College in New York City about labor issues and lessons. Tommy Whittington is a scholar and an activist living in Troy. His work focuses on Black resistance in the U.S., especially the genesis of the Black Lives Matter movement. This is part two of a two-part interview, with the first half is available online.
Let's talk a little bit about the mass incarceration thing.
Sure.
Because you did say that some of these organizations who ended up being a part of Black Lives Matter, but had been doing work before, were focusing in areas of mass incarceration and policing well before famous events like the death of Mike Brown. And I wonder if we could talk a little bit about the history of mass incarceration as it relates to like Black resistance.
Right. And so I've been thinking about this. As I said before, I do historical sociology. And one thing I kind of think that people get wrong, and the more I think about it, and the more I kind of look around the Black diaspora, I think black resistance is just a thing, right? It's just like a thing that's going to happen. And it's just like a part of our society because the countries in the New World were largely founded as slave societies, right? And so it's just like the way that the game's set up is that black resistance is going to happen just the same way that labor activism is just a part of the country, gender activism. Think like this is just always going to happen without end. It's just a question of what the context is. And I think that mass incarceration and I think over-policing provide the very real historical and institutional context that we saw the past 3-4 years of black activism occurring. And as I was kind of looking back, I was looking at this great rereading this great article by Pamela Oliver, who's a professor at the University of Wisconsin. And she makes the argument, following a few other scholars, namely Gary Marks, who focuses on policing in the 60s, that the kind of contemporary episode of mass incarceration isn't because of the war on drugs. It actually is kind of occurs as a response to the 60s riots and 60s activism and the kind of changes in laws of be it free assembly, protests, what's legal, what's arrestable, things like that. And also the very real repressive anti kind of protests, actions that the government was taking. She says that those protests of the 60s and riots of the 60s increased a policing and increased arrests, right? But that for black communities, that policing never subsided, right? And so the kind of contemporary black, I guess, racialized dynamic of policing that would ultimately become the kind of pretext for Black Lives Matter and the police killings of Mike Brown and Eric Garner. We should also very much note that George Zimmerman was not a police officer, and that's a whole different bag. You know, that these are, in a way, a response to the reactions of earlier waves of black protests. Does that make sense?
Sure. So you're saying that rather than being an independent phenomenon, the racialized policing of the 80s and into today mm-hmm. was actually a direct response to black resistance in the 60s and 70s.
Right, right. I think that, I wouldn't say direct because the drug war did happen, right? Like regime change did happen, Reagan,
sure, yeah.
So on and so forth. I would say it was you can't separate, inseparable maybe, you know?
Right.
So it's like there are other things that happened and kind of shaped, you know, kind of in the same way that, you know, ICE is a product of the Bush regime, right? And it's like, yeah, you can't think of this without understanding the prior context of racial immigration and stuff like that. But this is all to say that a lot of people kind of understand a kind of linear increase in policing when it's actually much more contingent, right? The government didn't have to change the laws, right, to repress black protests in the 60s, right, and riots in the 60s, but right. It did. Did you have? I'm sorry.
I have a bunch of questions. Yeah. One of them is that do you see a relationship between the like blanket drug policing and like broken windows policing mm. that was introduced in the 80s? Mm-hmm. And do you see a relationship between that and the like more targeted methods of COINTELPRO and similar anti-black power efforts?
Ooh, wow, that's a great question. I think that.
And for those who don't know, COINTELPRO was a counterintelligence program the FBI operated in order to disperse black power organizations in the 70s.
Who was it? Hoover, right? Was it Edgar?
I think it was Edgar.
I don't know. It was Edgar Hoover. Yeah, that's right. So that's to say, ooh, that's a tough question. I would say that I genuinely, honestly, in my heart, believe that the 80s Republican administration, Reagan, but also just like the Republican establishment in the 80s, genuinely had a different agenda in pursuing drug trafficking and drug use. And I think that it's not necessarily a, what's the word I want to use? It's not necessarily like a directly racialized, and this is kind of how the outcomes of policies in a white supremacist society will tend to be white supremacists, no matter, unless
sure,
you
yeah.
incorporate some kind of anti-racist kind of, you know, be it affirmative action, things like that, right? I genuinely think that they enacted those policies out of a legitimate concern for communities and for drug trafficking. I also think that those kinds of institutional powers that they granted, right, those kinds of law enforcement powers and changes that occurred in the 80s occurred in a context that in which those the institutions were already laid on top of Black communities in a disproportionate way, right? So it's like, and we can see this in contemporary discussions of policing, in terms of drugs in particular, right? Looking at, like, we know that drug use is not necessarily, in, especially at the city level, I'm thinking of recent discussions about New York. It's like, we know that drug use occurs in white communities in New York City just as much, but we also know that the arrest rates are much lower in the white communities, right? So it's like one of those things where it's like, something's wrong here. And so it's like, it's more of a layered cake, I guess would be a better, I think it's easier to understand as a layered cake than to kind of try to read into a, into the Reagan administration in the 80s, a real deep fear of like Black activism that for a lot of, I think, hadn't been seen on the scale as in the 60s.
I see. Mm-hmm. The narrative that you're talking about, mm-hmm. where mass incarceration of the second half of the 20th century is sort of a child of the 60s and a sort of indirect mm-hmm. Result of the response to Black activism. Mm-hmm. And that narrative conflicts with the more popular narrative right now, that mass incarceration in the second half of the 20th mm-hmm. century is simply a development of the Jim Crow era policies.
Right.
And I wonder if you could talk about that, or if you see a conflict there or not.
Yeah. I think that... And it's also interesting because there's a certain generation of Americans that we're, you know, are quite old now that would remember kind of the full kind of waxing and waning of Black activism over most of the 20th century, right? And so kind of, you know, starting with Garveyism, mm-hmm. Going through the World War II veterans, going through the Civil Rights era, Black Power, now we're here. And that's to say that I think that the kind of understanding of Jim Crow inevitably leading to mass incarceration or naturally leading to mass incarceration is a very cynical kind of view of history and, mm-hmm. and social change, which I'm a cynic, yes. Very sympathetic, but I think that there's so many things that didn't have to happen, right? But they did, right? So the kind of urban riots of the 60s didn't have to happen, but they did, right? The ensuing federal government and state government's responses to riots. They didn't have to happen that way, but they did. And I think that there's episodes in the history, be it the civil rights movement, right, that are surrounded by episodes of Black activism, right? So what happened between Garveyism in the early days of the NAACP and the civil rights movement, right? What happened between the end of the Black Power era and Black Lives Matter, you know, if you want to kind of go the more cultural route, you could also definitely talk about the kind of Black consciousness kind of movement of the early 90s that brought us like Public Enemy, things like that, right? But that's to say that Jim Crow and the kind of policies and ways of policing Black people and keeping them out of public space and subservient were a different kind of institutional logic, right? And so it was a legally codified, right, in race laws, right, in the Southeast, right, segregation laws, right, or informally enforced, right? So this law on paper, we're supposed to serve you, we're supposed to give you tickets to the movie theater, but whenever Black people show up, we decide to close up shop, right? Mass incarceration is a different, it's literally a different institution, right? It's different laws, right? And so I think it's really important not to conflate kind of either legal or functional segregation with the kind of maybe more benevolent or colorblind logic that allows Black people to be incarcerated in astronomical rates, even so much that society is literally warped, like racially warped, right? By legal standards, right? And so it's like these things were both legal, right? But it's like the way that they are done, be it in Jim Crow through like jobs and employment service, right? It's not the same thing as putting people away. You could be put away for violating Jim Crow, sure, but it's not the same kind of function.
I see. Mm-hmm. It sounds to me like another aspect of this is that if you draw a linear narrative between, you know, slavery to Jim Crow mm-hmm. to mass incarceration, mm-hmm. that could have the effect of erasing the nuances of Black resistance strategies and the way that they affected the way, you know, the state repression. Is that true?
I think I would agree with that, right? I think it's just a question of what do you get out of the narrative, right? What is the narrative for? And so I think that there's great books, you know, be it Michelle Alexander's classic, right? Loic Wacquant wrote about kind of these how slavery is remade over time. I think that it's useful to kind of say that, to point over a long historical span of America to kind of show how Black populations have been, you know, disenfranchised. I think that that's really great, and I think that's really important to kind of get people to the beginning of the conversation, right? Of saying, well, what does structural racism look like? So on and so forth. I think at the end, though, it's like at some point you have to get to the nitty gritty. And I think that people that are focusing on like doing this change and doing anti-racist work are a lot more kind of at that end of saying like, we know structural racism exists. These are kind of assumptions before we kind of do the work. But it's more of, okay, if I'm a, and so I think a good example is thinking about what the tactics that like Southern Christian Leadership coalition we're doing, Martin Luther King, so on and so forth, we're doing in the South versus kind of Northern tactics, right? Or the tactics of the NAACP, right? And things like this, right? Those are different tactics. People use those different tactics because they had different realities on the ground. And so I think that that narrative is useful, but I think it's like once you kind of get to the nitty gritty, there's different laws and different institutions that you have to kind of put pressure on, right, in order to kind of get to hopefully make Black activism successful. And so I think that, yeah, I'm here for the grand historical narratives, but I'm also like a nerd for the question of social change, right? So how do people make change? And I think that that kind of requires having a much finer kind of scope of questioning what is really making Black disenfranchisement happen in this one specific place and time.
Sure. So maybe we could, with that in mind, and with the few minutes we have left, we could bring this idea back to the present. The idea that there's a dialectic relationship between Black activism and state repression, and that sometimes the way that the state is oppressive is a response to particular strategies and tactics of activism. So what is happening now? Mm-hmm. How has the state responded to Black Lives Matter activism? And in what ways do you see methods of repression changing or shifting?
Oh, wow. That's a huge... so much there. The way that we learn history and the way that history is taught popularly in the United States is kind of this progression, right? I think the kind of the way that sociologists kind of think of it without history and that are focused more contemporary is kind of a lever of a back and forth struggle, like a seesaw. And I think if you combine those things, you end up with like a rhizome, right? Like a root that encounters a stone in its path and goes another way and then another rock, right? There's so much. I think that Blue Lives Matter is a thing. So I think that there's been a kind of a few different things, right? I personally think that, and I think that if you look at the Southern strategy and kind of that dynamic, that relationship from the Nixon campaign, right, to the Black activism that was happening at that time is interestingly paralleled with Trump.
That was Tommy Weddington, local scholar and activist, in conversation with Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Jonah Moberg. Part one of that interview is available online.
That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm your host, H. Bosch Jr.
And I'm your other host, Guy Schaefer. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. Also be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, WOOC 105.3 is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio efforts, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks again for tuning in.